It's a pleasure to be here. I've been looking forward to this opportunity to speak to you. The theme of the conference is one that is close to my heart, and especially in the academic context. I'm going to be speaking on the inner life, shaping the inner world, shaping our inner world. I'm going to be saying a few things which may startle you and perhaps offend you, and if so, I'm asking forgiveness ahead of time. But the issues are very deep and very important, and I want to address them as forthrightly and as strongly as I can. I would begin with some words from Paul. You'll remember in 1 Corinthians 1:24, he uses the language, "But to those who believe Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God." And then again in Colossians 2:3, "For in him are hid all the treasures of wisdom and of knowledge." And sometimes when we read the scripture, it's helpful to pay attention to the little trivial grammatical points and to ask ourselves questions like, all the wisdom, all the treasures, how many does that leave out? How many are left out? And for example, looking ahead now and trying to prime your thinking about your own field, how much would you say there is in your own field that Jesus Christ does not know? You see, we have to reposition him very firmly for our work. And if we speak of following Christ, we can only follow Christ where he is. And if he's not ahead of us in our field, we can't follow him in our field. And so when we speak of shaping our inner world now, we're going to have to come to deal with some of the deepest ideas and beliefs and ways of thinking about things that we have, so deep that we may not even have identified them as such. The mark of our real beliefs and of our culture is that we don't even identify them. They just seem like part of the furniture. But if we're going to follow Christ in the academic context, we have to see him as one who is already there, who is out ahead of us, who knows what we need to know, who understands what we don't understand. And we have to also understand that he, in that context, offers us the fullness of his life, the absolute paragon and image of all goodness and all rightness. And in the context in which we live and work, he says to us, in those respects, follow me. 1 Corinthians 13, Matthew 5, Colossians 3, all of those great high points in Scripture that spell out the character of Jesus Christ. That is for us. Now, with that just brief introduction, I want to begin the body of what I have to say by recalling some of the language that was provided by those who set up this conference. And this is in some of your material that you've received. In some of that material, it is stated that, quote, "scholars such as George Marsden, Mark Knoll, Mark Schwinn, and others have described a vast gulf separating Christianity from the intellectual and ideological life of North America, of North American culture, and particularly from North American higher education. This gulf," I'm continuing to quote, "this gulf has contributed to the profound gap between the personal life of Christian scholars and the professional and intellectual work that they perform." I want to address that gap. Quoting Mark Knoll, "modern American evangelicals have largely abandoned the universities and the arts and the other realms of high culture." continuing with the language, modern, that this void in the public square is echoed by a deeply personal one in the lives of graduate and professional students pursuing advanced degrees without a vital community of peers to challenge and encourage them. Many Christian graduate and professional students experience isolation and loneliness, and when their academic life becomes sharply separated from their spiritual pursuits. See that gulf again? Their academic life becomes sharply separated from their spiritual pursuits. Their Christian faith is at risk. There's a problem, isn't there? It has many aspects. Not least the problems that are created by the fact that the university and college system is now the authority center of our culture. That means that people tend to automatically accept what comes out of it without really examining it. And sometimes it is terribly mistaken in what comes out of it. It can be vastly wrong. And so we must understand carefully what is at issue here. The deep division that is addressed by these words between intellectual, artistic, academic, and the faith in Jesus Christ that really has formed the traditions of Western culture, including education, that gap, that deep division in life, is a matter of what is recognized as knowledge in our culture. The primary problem derives from the fact that the content of Christian teaching is not regarded as a body of knowledge. And you may be shocked to even hear someone raise that as an issue. It may be that your feelings and your thoughts and your habits are, well, of course it is not knowledge, it's faith. But if you say that, you have touched in your own soul the root of the division which is deplored in the words that we've just read. The idea that these are different worlds. The problem with which this conference is concerned is not something peripheral to the academic and intellectual situation of our day. It has to do with the course content that is regarded as acceptable in our colleges and universities, and with what is regarded as appropriate research programs and methods of knowledge. The very root of our difficulty is that a world without God has been allowed to define what counts as knowledge. And what we must understand is that if we would shape our world, if we would follow Christ, not just in the university setting, but in any setting today, we have to meet our world with a challenge to the content of courses that are taught throughout our academic system, whether it's in secular schools or in sacred schools, as that language is used. We have to understand that we cannot overcome the gap by being better persons alone. We cannot overcome the gap by being more spiritual alone. In fact, it is the attack on the content of the Christian tradition as a knowledge tradition that undermines our ability to be better persons, and to even have solid moral guidance. More on that in a moment. For two or more centuries, Christianity has been on the defensive intellectually. It has been deemed by many to have lost. And this is not a new story. Max Müller, a distinguished scholar of the last century, in 1878, had this to say. Every day it is announced from the most widely read journals that the time for religion is past, that faith is a hallucination or an infantile disease, that the gods have at last been found out and exploded. Diogenes Allen, in his book Christian Belief in a Postmodern World, comments that subject after subject is studied in our universities without reference to God, so that anyone educated outside the church, schools, or college is given the impression that religious questions are not among the fundamental questions which any person who uses his or her head has to confront sooner or later. Well, that's a situation. Many people might even be surprised that one should raise it as an issue. But again, I say to you that that's just another indication of how fundamental it has become to our way of thinking. The very idea that subjects in universities should not be taught without reference to God would be regarded as scandalous by many. My way of putting the point is to say that there's not a single field of thought or practice in our world today where knowledge of God is regarded as essential to competence. And one might say, well, there is one, the ministry, but I'll challenge you to think on that, because in fact there are some circles in which you could even say that it is a qualification for ministry to maintain that knowledge of God is impossible. And I can give you quotations and sources afterwards if you'd like to go into that. Now, what I need to say to you very simply to begin with is this. This is not a problem that lies outside of us as a Christian community of scholars. It lies within us. It does that because of the way we've been trained. We have been trained in a methodology that leaves God out entirely and does not make knowledge of God relevant to our competence as teachers. We are now products of that system. We have learned to think of our own image in this way. We regard ourselves, our respect as scholars, as those who are prepared to pursue our own field without any reference to the knowledge of God. Yet, even though that is within us, I agree with David Gill, quoted also on the face of the brochure that announced this conference. He says, I am thoroughly convinced it is not only biblically mandated, but really possible for Christians studying in secular universities and working in a pluralistic world to develop unified Christian perspectives, and now please note, on their fields, and then to think, work, and live as veritable salt and light in the midst of that world. And I believe that is possible. But it is really possible only if we understand the transformation of our own inner life, beginning with our most basic ideas about what counts as reality and what counts as knowledge, coming down to further points like developing an epistemology of the Bible as a way of knowing God, coming on down to the very concrete details of our own fields and knowing the presence of Christ in those fields. But we have to be transformed. You see, if you ask almost any person who is the most brilliant person in their field, you will rarely ever hear anyone say, "It is Jesus himself." Who is the greatest mathematician that ever lived? Who's the greatest economist? Who's the greatest philosopher? If you ask in general who's the smartest man that ever lived, you will rarely get, "Well, it's Jesus Christ," except perhaps from some child in Sunday school who's been told that Jesus is the greatest person in every respect. Now you see, that goes to the heart of our thinking. And in fact, if you raise the issue of Jesus' intelligence, you may be thought to be joking. And yet, the same person who thinks this is somehow out of place, an oxymoron, and I've had Christians say that to me gently, to speak of Jesus as intelligent is an oxymoron. If you think that way, what can your discipleship to him mean? If Jesus is truly Lord, how dumb do you think he could be? You see, we have a problem of adjusting our inner perception of Jesus. And unless we can make the shift to where we take him seriously and regard his teachings about reality as fundamental truths which will stand up in the arena where we work, whether it's physics or New Testament theology or whatever it may be, if we cannot think of ourselves as living in that area with him, then we are unable to be his disciples and to look to him and to trust him, and we park him at the door. And by contrast, I like to think of Jesus as someone who's perfectly at home in any professional context that you can imagine. In fact, he would greatly improve on most of them, not just by his knowledge, but by his spirit. The disconnections which we suffer from run very deep. They run from a view of the universe as a universe of random, impersonal, pointless action of material objects. That's accepted. You can say that and no one will think there's something wrong with you in your professional context. Don't worry about whether or not it's true. You see, that view is authoritative. That view underlies the idea that God is irrelevant to any field of professional competence. Jesus Christ did not believe in that view of the universe. Now, obviously, we don't do our work simply by quoting him as an authority. We do our work by asking him to stand with us in our work. As we stand for a universe that is ultimately Trinitarian at the bottom, personal, purposeful, the kingdom of God. The former view, random, impersonal, pointless, is the reality of academic culture. The latter is the reality of Christian revelation. They cannot coexist in the same mind. And one of the reasons why in the academic world many Christians have a constant struggle of faith is because they are taking too seriously the random, impersonal, pointless view of the universe as an authoritative position. And they do not stand confidently with the knowledge that a universe as Trinitarian, as personal, as purposeful, as creative, as full of freedom and beauty is a reality. And that's the kind of position we must change. Very quickly, I have 4 points that I want to talk about as the way back. And I've gotten cleared by the authorities to go a little past my 11 o'clock time. So I'll have a few more minutes. What is the way back? This is perhaps the most contentious thing I will say to you. I've already said it. I want to say it again. And if you carry one thing away with you, I hope it will be this. In the renewing of our inner world, we have to understand our ideas and our beliefs must integrate with the fact that the central content of the Christian tradition is a tradition of knowledge. It's not a tradition of wild leaps and blind guesses. We know about God. We know it on the basis of reality that has been experienced and lived with and tested. When you think of the Apostles' Creed, do you think of it as a body of knowledge? I challenge you to try it on. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ. What are we doing when we say that? I knew a psychological counselor in Madison, Stan, when we were there, who prescribed to some of his patients to go to the large congregational church that was there on the corner, just for the benefit of standing with them and confessing the psychological benefit. And many people are tempted to think, even Christians to think, well, it's good for us to say this. And it is. But when we speak of renewing the inner person in such a way that we can talk about following Christ in our world and shaping that world, because we are inwardly reformed, we're talking about people who, when they say this, recognize that they are making a statement of what is the case on an appropriate basis of experience and thought. And I give you that as a simple description of knowledge. You have knowledge of something when you can represent it as it is on an appropriate basis of experience and thought. And what we stand for as Christians in the central creedal tradition of Christianity, what C.S. Lewis used to call mere Christianity, the center of the teaching, is the most important knowledge the human race has ever touched. It's given to us. And it competes in any context. An old English philosopher that has much to say, L.T. Hobhouse, used to say, all that religion requires of philosophy is a fair field and no quarter given. And that's where we stand. And we stand here and we must affirm this. It must be something that we in our hearts have settled, that when we express the central truths of the Christian faith, we are standing on a solid basis which competes in any context. And then as we do our work, we want to work with that sense of the centrality of our knowledge of reality in the context where we live. I want to say something now that I'm cautious about saying, because I know that I'm addressing an issue that people have taken sides on. There is a view about Christian scholarship that Christian scholarship is scholarship done by Christians. Christian scholarship is scholarship done by Christians. And if I may put it humorously, I think that's no more true than Christian pies are pies made by Christians. Christian scholarship can be very unchristian. If you mean by Christian scholarship, scholarship done by Christians. Christian scholarship is scholarship, I believe, that is appropriately informed by confidence in the truth of the basic Christian teachings. Now, we live in an atmosphere where it is sometimes hard to sustain that. And indeed, here we begin to touch over on the other side of the inner transformation of our world. Because in order to follow Christ in our world, in order to shape our world, we have to be people of virtue, of courage, of temperance, of wisdom, of justice, the great four cardinal virtues of classical thought. But we know we cannot live by those alone. By the time the Christian church had come along, it had been effectively proven that those great virtues could not support themselves. They had to be based in the Christian theological virtues of faith and hope and love. But you see, as we come to follow Christ and we hear the message of the gospel, he then calls us and shows us the way into the inner transformation where we stand with faith and hope and love. And that gives us courage and temperance and wisdom and justice, because it plants us firmly in the reality of the triune God which stands at the foundation of the universe. And we must stand courageously knowing that nothing has been found out that refutes the tradition of knowledge in which we stand. I want to say that again because, you see, there's such a widespread idea that somehow, somewhere, someone has found that there is no God the Father. And you find it scattered through the literature. And you read your Freud, and you read your Marx, and you read your Nietzsche, and you read your whoever. And there's often expressly stated that someone has shown that all of the religious beliefs are true. Read Freud's The Future of an Illusion, and you'll find a lovely illustration of that. I don't have time to quote from it this morning. But just read that and see how he will just offhandedly state, well, all of this has been shown wrong. Now, when you hear that said, or when that sense is there, I encourage you, with the courage of Christ and with the love of Christ, to say gently, where, how, when? Let's look at it. Let's see if this is really so. You see, what has been created is an atmosphere. It isn't that, as Butler said long ago, someone has found out, Christianity has been found out. It isn't that what is stated by Christ and in his tradition of teaching has been shown wrong. Not at all. And again, if you're troubled with that, let's talk about it. I'll be glad to try to say what I can that would be helpful on this point. But we have to understand that what has happened with the passage of time is that an atmosphere has been created. Decisions have been taken. When William Graham Sumner in the 1890s made the statement to Noah Porter that God had nothing to do with the subject matter of political science, he was not announcing a discovery. He was announcing a decision. And that decision was made in an atmosphere that was being negotiated. There's a quotation in Brideshead Revisited that so beautifully expresses this atmosphere that we have to deal with. Charles Ryder says, Sebastian's faith, Sebastian was the Catholic believer in the book, as you may know. Sebastian's faith was an enigma to me at the time, not one which I felt particularly concerned to solve. The view implicit in my education was that the basic narrative of Christianity had long been exposed as a myth. Notice he said, this is so well done. Evelyn Waugh knew exactly what he was after. The view implicit in my education. Implicit, not explicit. You know, the strongest arguments are the ones you don't even have to state. They are the ones that carry things. You don't even state them. And then you embarrass people who want to raise them. That's the way the atmosphere works. And what we want to do is to understand what is happening there. Christianity has long been exposed as a myth. That opinion was now divided as to whether its ethical teaching was of present value, a division on which the main weight went against.